Welcome to another episode of Film 45, the podcast about filmmaking here in the North. Today, we've got kind of a two-part episode talking about the new show in town, the Next Level Expo. And we chat with cinematographer and AC and business owner, Steve Spears.
To Film 45.
Things to look out for and put on your calendar. Coming up in August on the 23rd, 2018, there is a Minnesota Film and TV Town Hall meeting. It's going to be from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. at 56 Brewing. And it is the summer Town Hall meeting at the Tap Room. Have a beer, network, and get an update from Executive Director Melody Behan about the Minnesota Film and TV Board and what's going on here in the North. The recently held Film North Forum, July 14th to 15th, was a success in my opinion. The panel discussions were super interesting, very well thought out, and very chock full of information. And you know what? I think this is a good format going forward. Making it bigger and better, sure, that'd be great too. But this was something that you should not have missed. And I was very happy to be there. Look forward to it happening again next year. And now we'll get to the meat of the news, which is the upcoming Next Level Expo being hosted over at and by Cinemechanics. We've got a guest with us to talk all about it, and that'll just go right into our normal profile piece here on Film 45 with Steve Spears, cinematographer, AC, and owner of Cinemechanics. Well, welcome to the show, Steve. It's good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you are hosting, or you're the organizer of the Next Level Expo that's coming up in just about a week from this record date.
Yeah, it's July 31st, and my company, Cinemechanics, is hosting a film community event called the Next Level Expo with some manufacturers of both camera systems and camera movement systems that we hope to show off to the people in our market to open them up to some new ideas.
Yeah, that's cool. And you've got big companies and you've got local companies. Specifically, you mentioned camera movement. I know you've got the Motocrane crew coming here, and they're based over in, just Minneapolis, I guess, maybe. So they have a Russian arm style camera car rig that they manufacture right here in Minnesota.
Yeah, so they're one of the manufacturers that's going to be at the Next Level Expo, and they have found a market for building and selling what our industry knows as a Russian arm or a crane mounted arm on a car. And it's often used for tracking and for car commercials and all sorts of things that take place on a roadway. So they're going to be here, and they're going to actually be unveiling their new system, which I believe they're calling the Ultra. It's their version 2. And they're super excited about the event, and they've got people coming in just to see it. So we're excited that they're able to be a part of it, and they're going to give a presentation on their arm car, their system that they're nearly done creating, as well as talking about how to do some vehicle tracking work in a real production environment, some of the concerns and things that you need to know if you're going to tackle that.
Yeah, it's cool. I got to get those guys on to the show too. What camera manufacturers can people expect to meet and see here?
So we have Red Digital that's going to be here with one of their representatives to discuss their three new major cameras, the Monstro, the Gemini, and the Helium. And they're going to be here to answer any of the questions that people may have about the cameras, if they're an owner, if they're an operator, or just interested in moving from the current camera they're using to something else. We'll also have Sony, who is going to be here and represented on behalf of Able Cine, So we'll have the full-frame Sony Venice camera here in-house from them. And then, so as far as camera manufacturers, those are the two main ones. And then Abel Cine will also be here as a rep on behalf of Phantom, since they're the local dealer for that camera. And they can also be a, they'll also be a resource for people who have questions about Arri, which we're also a big fan of, and any other camera system.
Okay. And talk a little bit more about Abel Cine, because I guess maybe the average filmmaker might know them as like a place where they maybe can buy gear from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Abel Cine's history is that they were in the rental business, primarily as a Anton 16mm film camera system, and they eventually built up to where they were doing sales. And, but yeah, they are a rental house by history, and now they've blossomed into being, a sales company, both online and, sort of a, I guess, a brick and mortar sales room in both New York and LA and Chicago. So, but they have been a provider to us for a lot of our purchases that we use in our rental business. And, we use them primarily because their service standards are so high that they have been able to help us out in ways that other providers and salespeople haven't. But they are well known now as a sales company.
And weren't they the source of some of like the Sony profiles when like the FS100 and 700 came out, and they posted like the profiles on how to get the most dynamic range out of them? Weren't they the ones that did that?
Yeah, so
they've been providing, you know, online resources too.
Yeah, what's great about them is that they are technically savvy and they understand the industry. It's very important to them that the people who buy their stuff get the most out of their stuff. So they do have a lot of support. They also have a lot of training that you can attend, courses on certain camera systems, or being a colorist, or being an AC, or, you know, they can be broad industry type jobs that they teach you how to do, or very specific things like learning Resolve or the Sony Venice or whatever it may be. So they're big on both the sales, but they're also very big on the service and the training, which is, I think, what's been the key to their success.
Okay. And then also on the promos you've been passing around online, you've mentioned lenses and many different types of lenses. Why don't you talk about the types of glass people might experience here?
Yeah, so one thing that Cine Mechanics has always sort of strived to offer is optics for people that are maybe not what they use every day, but they're primarily lenses that might be used in high-end commercial work or feature film work. But we specialize in PL mount Cine lenses for the most part, anything from vintage, which we would categorize as something like a Canon K35 or Zeiss Super Speeds. We also have some lenses that we've removed the coatings from that offer unique looks that we want people to know about. There's also been some reissues of some old lenses that have been put into modern housings that we've invested in. Primarily, it's things like the Cook Pancros, which were from the 30s, that they've now rebuilt into modern glass housings. We also have some anamorphics in the vintage side, Zakawa anamorphics, and on the high-end modern side, the Cook anamorphics. So we try to cater to people who don't use the same lenses every day and are trying to use the lenses that might be selected specifically for the look of a project. So we're hoping that people can come to the expo and maybe show them some reasons why the everyday lens might not be the right lens for everything.
And going back to motion, what other kind of motion or camera rigging can attendees see here?
Yeah, so we're going to have a few different setups that we have the Movi Pro platform on. We'll have a tracking vehicle, which is a Polaris Ranger, which will have a black arm vibration isolator, and that will be on the rig that people will be able to see. We'll also have a fly line set up, which is like basically often referred to as a cable cam, that will also be remotely controlled both on the line as well as from on a Movi for camera operation. We have wireless controls for a Movi, which were are called Alpha Wheels, which is basically back to the old geared head that we'll be demoing. We also have, we're trying to nail down if eGripment, a local dealer, like they're based out of just the west side of or east side of Minnesota, Wisconsin area, in which they're going to have their telescope and crane. That's still sort of TBD, but those are the sorts of camera movement things. We'll also have a rickshaw dolly that we've had custom made for people to use for a running platform and an operating platform. Some of the stuff people have seen, we're hoping that the people who maybe haven't seen it can come and get a taste of what it might be.
Okay. Is there anything else with the expo that you want to make sure to mention that will be here that I haven't prompted you for yet?
No, I think part of it is the event is an opportunity for people to come and see things that maybe they've been wanting to try or to learn about. Or it's also going to be a little bit of a networking and social opportunity for people. We also hope people can come to the expo with their questions for Able Cine, for Red Digital, and for Sony, as far as like questions they have to get the most out of their products as well. So it's really a hope to get people to think on the next stage of their work, let's say, or to start to think about a way that they're going to maybe utilize something new like the Moto crane or a jib arm with a remote head or something. Stuff that some people use frequently, but others maybe haven't had a chance to try or learn about.
So for those maybe who are curious about this or who are maybe beginners or intermediate, what would you say to them? I mean, this is a free event you're putting on, correct?
Correct, absolutely free.
And so everyone is welcome. For somebody who's maybe not as experienced with some of this higher-end gear, what should they be asking or looking for?
Yeah, I think if they have a project in mind that they're working on, that they might have a shot they're trying to achieve or a look they're trying to achieve, this would be a great event to come to and maybe start to source some of the answers to those questions. It also will be an opportunity for people who maybe haven't seen something or maybe only read about it to actually come and see in person, maybe and just like get their hands on it and get a real demonstrative experience of how something might work to, again, help to answer their question on what they might want to try. I think the experience level is going to vary as far as people who want to attend or should attend it. It's open to everybody. It's a free event. But it's anybody who's got kind of like a passion to using some of the filmmaking tools to properly build around a project that they might have in mind, whether it's something they're doing now or whether it's something they've been wanting to do stylistically in their career, whether it's the look of an image, the use of a lens, the right way to set up a camera. I think there can be a lot of things that people could get out of it and get answered.
Awesome. And why don't you just run down the details real quick? So where and when, and I'll put all the pertinent details in the show notes.
Sure. The event is hosted by Cine Mechanics. It's going to be at our office in St. Louis Park, which is, the address is 7600 West 27th Street, and we are Suite 210, and it's also going to be in Suite 211, and then we'll have a number of things out in the parking lot area as well. The event is on Tuesday, July 31st, and it takes place from 1 to 6 p.m., in which we'll have open demos all day from 1 to 6 for people to just kind of stop on by and see what they might want to, you know, get their hands on. And then at 2 p.m., we have a scheduled presentation by Moto Crane, which will be about their Ultra 2 arm on their tracking vehicle. The rig will be here. It will have a Movi XL on it, and they're really excited about showing it off. And that's at 2 p.m. And then at 4 p.m., Able Cine is going to lead a discussion on full-frame imaging and full-frame cameras in the sense that if you want to learn a little bit about the cameras that are being pitched out there right now to do full frame photography, and maybe learn a little about those systems and the cameras, then that's a presentation that takes place at 4. And we're going to have the cameras here. The experts will be here to ask questions to. The cameras, you'll be able to test out and see. And we'll also have some conversations about lensing and stuff like that about that. So basically from 1 to 6 and then 2 o'clock presentation of Motocrane and 4 o'clock presentation on full frame.
All right, great. Thanks. Now let's go back to, I guess, what would typically be our regularly scheduled podcast where I ask you, who are you and what do you do? So more of our profile piece that listeners usually expect. So Steve, you've worked on a lot of stuff that's come through town. You work on a lot of stuff out of town, as I understand, too. Take us back to how you got your start, I guess. Go. Did you know like out of college or high school that you wanted to get into this career, or when did that light bulb go off for you?
Well, I guess in high school I did a lot of playing around with video cameras at the time, where all of a sudden something that people could have, believe it or not. That was a while back. I went to Stillwater High School and they had a video yearbook class. It was the first class in the country to offer a video yearbook as an idea, as opposed to the written hardcover book. And the equipment was all donated by a Stillwater resident who we probably know, Stan Hubbard. So we had an editing system and cameras when I was in high school, a long time ago.
Was this just like tossed off stuff from the TV station or?
They actually bought us like a linear editing system.
Okay.
And it was all VHS. And maybe that's where I got a little bit of the interest in college. I kind of studied telecommunications, but didn't. The big step was I did a couple internships, one for MTV Networks and another one for A&M Records. And then I went on to intern after college at Nickelodeon Studios in Orlando, where I worked on a bunch of TV shows there. Then I came back and PA'd and worked on feature films, primarily in the art department, because that's where the work was at the time. And eventually went back and got to know a lot of the camera guys and worked as a loader. I came up in the camera department as a loader and a second AC for many years, working on features and music videos and commercials and stuff around town. And then worked as a camera assistant focus puller for a number of cinematographers on various features as well, in between commercial jobs. And eventually, you know, now I shoot and I still like to AC for certain people, and on certain level of projects, I still AC quite a bit. And eventually over time, I started purchasing equipment that I wanted to be using, and that grew into what is now Cine Mechanics, which is a small sort of boutique camera rental house that kind of is sticking to the higher end projects, mainly because I wanted to stay in Minnesota and wasn't interested in living in LA, but wanted to kind of work at maybe a level that people were doing in bigger markets.
Now you I think are, I would say, known for having access to, again, some of these, like you said, higher end equipment, vintage glass or specialized glass. How do you I guess create that kind of business in Minnesota? Maybe when, you know, we're not the East Coast, we're not the West Coast LA scene. You know, our movie production has dramatically dropped off from what it used to be. There's lots of indie stuff going on, but not the bigger profile stuff as much. So how do you make a go of it? Is it mainly servicing commercial and corporate entities, or I don't know, just tell us a little bit about the decision to start the business and how do you run it here?
Yeah, well, the decision to start the business was really just kind of just grew into what it is because I certain sorts of equipment I wanted to work with and have access to. So when I could afford it, I purchased it and was able to rent that on jobs. But how do we make a go of it? It is a small market, and we've had some very good years of bigger budget projects, but the industry's changed a lot. So right now it's No, it's a small market. So not all the jobs require the sort of stuff that we offer. So hopefully when there is a job that is in need of the sort of service and equipment that we provide, that we're the ones who are able to help out on that. And so it's really just been over the years of getting to know a lot of different production companies, a lot of different DPs, a lot of different directors and producers. These people cycle through our market every few years. And when you build relationships with them and you do a good job, they come back. I guess our hope is that we can offer some things to some people who might not be able to, might not use it every day based on certain projects or budgets. But when they do, they think of us as a place to get something that will give their project or their images a boost or a look that they're experimenting with. But it's hard. It's a small market, you know, and we've got people who do all range of budgets here, and we're just happy and honored if they give us a call to be a part of it.
And, you know, it's worth pointing out that this is not maybe a mutually exclusive type of community, because you will subrent your gear, right,
yes,
to other entities in town.
Yes. So we share sub-rentals with other rental houses. We also have a network of rental houses outside of Minneapolis that we provide equipment to, and also that we sub-rent from, depending on what's needed.
Yeah. And, this is a small town, but there's enough work to go around. We don't have to be like protective of, you know, well, Steve's only got, he's the only one that's got the super speeds in town and you can't get him anywhere else except directly through him. And,
right.
I don't know, whatever. But, you know, there's sometimes I see a little bit of a mentality of some people like being hyper protective. And it's like, well, you know, you kind of don't really need to do that, because
right,
everyone's got their own niche, and you can do your own amount of work, and you don't have to.
There is. No, I think there's a lot of work in town as far as I see Minneapolis right now as almost a self-sustaining town, in the sense that the work's kind of become a little of a ritual, in the sense of when people do things. What we really need or want would be directors that are fresh and energetic and can build a little bit of a following here that will allow for some better creative and better budgets and allow people to push their careers a little bit. But yeah, no, this market it's a small market. Everybody, we like to say around here, it's a 2-minute town, because we know everybody, we hear about all the jobs, and oftentimes we have a hand in many of them, which we're happy to be a part of.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about your movie career, I guess. So you've worked on stuff like Wilson, which I had the fortune to see the premiere of it at Sundance, and it played really well to the room, by the way. It's kind of disappointing that it didn't have a bigger commercial success, but
right,
I enjoyed it. You worked on stuff like Bernie, Coen Brothers stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you've done all kinds of stuff. And then you also do like In an Instant for TV. Mm-hmm. So tell us about what the differences are, what you like about the film world versus the TV world versus the commercial world. Maybe just give us some insights on some of those projects and
yeah,
what your thoughts are.
Yeah, no, I've been lucky to have a wide variety of projects to have worked on. I think part of it might have just been the timing of when I was able to get into this business and the type of work that was being done here at the time in the 90s was bigger budget movies. And it was possible to work 3 months on a movie, have a month off, and there was another one around the corner. And you could do that for a number of years. So at that time, it was almost an apprenticeship where you learned a lot just by being a part of a project for many, many weeks. And along with that comes a sort of a in the trenches sort of bond with the people you work with. And they call you again if it goes well. And I was fortunate that on a number of those projects that the people who came in from out of town, I got to know quite well and worked hard for, and got invited to work with them on some other projects. So that's kind of how I got to work on things like Royal Tenenbaums and Bernie and and things like that. But again, that I hate to change the topic, but that's where we also need these incentives and things like that for people to have a little more boot camp experience to learn. But my career is, you know, fortunate that the timing of when it was, there was a lot going on and I was able to learn a ton, build a lot of great relationships, maintain them, work hard whenever those opportunities came up. And, you know, for any one project, there's a story behind how it happened for me, you know.
What would you say has been like one of your big breaks or one thing you did to, you know, do extra hustle to get on that one project?
I guess a great opportunity would have been, well, maybe about the first one that I was not even aware of, which was even when I was in the art department, I worked on this little movie called Fargo. And that was my first movie I ever worked on. I had no idea really much about it or the process and in a lot of cases how the business worked. But that was a nice break, but it wasn't until a couple of years later that I realized it was as good of a break as it was. But I guess otherwise, some of the best breaks might have been the ones that weren't as obvious, like the first person who let me come in and load mags for them, you know, because they didn't have anybody and they trusted me enough. Those are big breaks. It's not a marquee type of break, but in a career, when you finally get somebody who can trust you to do something that is integral to their success, that's a break, because then you build it's an opportunity to build trust. So I see those ACs and those DPs that let me work as their loader or their camera assistant on those days when I was just green as can be, those were probably my big breaks. And those are what allowed me to work on the other projects where I could really come through for the people who I was working with. You know, and the ACs who came in on like Dairy Queens at the time were the ones who I went and worked with on Royal Tenenbaums. And they didn't need to ask a guy from Minneapolis to go to New York for 4 months. There's plenty of people in New York too. It was just relationships, hard work, and kind of hopefully knowing what you're doing when you get there. The others were all things like just relationships I built with a DP who had another project coming up, and he was able to bring me in to be his focus puller or operator or whatever it may be.
So it sounds like maybe there's a personality type or a skill that young people could build on, and that maybe would be being reliable, being trustworthy, and being a problem solver, if I'm not putting too many words in your mouth.
No, it's a lot of that. It's a lot of those exact things. It's hard work. It's being able to hang out with someone for 14 hours a day and not get under each other's skin. It's good work habits. It's knowing how to work, knowing how to load a truck, knowing how to be attentive. I think that's the big thing that existed when we shot film, is that everybody was highly attentive to what was going on. And there's a little bit of a thing called the crumbling of the craft that I say sometimes, because it is happening, in which so much can be dealt with in other ways that don't involve necessarily the same level of experiences that you might have needed to have previously. So I think it's harder now, in the sense that we don't have those sort of apprentice type opportunities here where you've worked with somebody who's been doing it for 15 to 30 years and has a method that is successful, and that's why they've been in the business so long. I think everything is really fragmented right now, and a lot of things we fall back on maybe post for or super sensitive camera for or whatever it is, that maybe some of the fundamentals we didn't have to really hone in on anymore. So it's different now for sure.
Yeah, I know that the topic of our sort of lack of mentors is something that's many people have raised. You know, at Film North, we do a fairly good job of servicing the beginning to intermediate filmmakers, but you know, what can we add to the advanced filmmaker, and how do we get those situations or those relationships of mentoring built up and have that kind of robust full career track here in town? You know, it's something that you know, we think about, and it's interesting to hear you talk a little bit about that. And the attentiveness, oh my God, like I can tell you, like on my own sets, which are, you know, microscopic compared to yours, I love somebody who is paying attention all the freaking time, because it's like, if you're not paying attention and you're not anticipating what's coming up, oh my God, just, it's so frustrating.
Yeah. Well, and it's, I think it's also hard too. I mean, when you think about what is needed, a lot of the jobs that are in a market like ours right now are a 1-day job, 3-day job, a week long job. And sometimes it's just the investment isn't long enough term to really always put in the detail that maybe it would require. And when you do a long-term project like a feature, you're in it for the haul. So you're going to learn how to load that truck properly every night. You're going to know how to clap the slate.
Yeah, because you're going to get the mess the next day if you don't.
Because you're dealing with it. So there's where the good habits, and there's where the routines, and there's where the discipline and the systems and the trust in the delegation of the crew, that all comes up. And that's what we're missing right now. So when you say things like mentors, it's like, I don't know that I can point to it existing right now in the market right now that's a 1 or 2 day thing. We need projects that are more longer term, where people are more fully invested in their time to then make the effort that will pay off for them. And I think that's what features do, or long-term, longer format episodic projects offer, and that's where you get it. I don't know of a better answer, unless you can, you know, you get a little bit from working at certain places. Like we have great staff here. They learn a lot from the people coming in and coming out, and that's their day-to-day, hands-on, touch it, do it, feel it sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So we're really happy with being able to offer that to the people who work here. And I think it's hard. I don't know. I think commercials, the 1-day jobs are hard to get a lot out of, to build a career. At least it takes a lot longer to build a career.
Mm. Yeah. Well, you're kind of digging into what's usually my closing question, which is what do you think the state of filmmaking is here in the North? So do you want to expound any further on that?
The state of filmmaking in the North is game for improvement. I can't knock it because it's been fantastic historically. But I think right now we're losing out, and we need to get back on the radar. We need to land a couple good-sized projects where people can really dig in and spend some time working on, that has a real backing of other professionals. And I think that spawns know-how and knowledge that can be used in the other projects that we see here in our state. I think anything we can do, whether it's nurturing a young, talented, potentially talented director to trying to lure a good-sized, mid-sized movie here, is great. Anything we can do to support a filmmaker's idea, those are all things that we are doing to a certain degree, but I think we just need to see more results.
Yeah, and you know, it's tough without having the funding and the snowbait, the film incentive package that we have, because so many other states do it more and do it better. And, you know, even California's got theirs back after a long time of not having much. So you're seeing a lot more stuff stay in LA or start in LA. But it seemed like we were really close with the Mogadishu, Minnesota project. You were involved in that a little bit, and it seems like maybe that fell apart mainly because of politics. Do you have any insights you want to share about that, or any thoughts?
No, I think what we did here with that project, as far as the pilot goes, they were thrilled about it. From what I understand, I wasn't part of any of the, you know, conversations really afterwards, but what I've gathered is that, you know, the local crew did a great job. The story was good. The idea and the concept of the show was fantastic. I think they got it back and were trying to figure out how to build it into a long-running episodic, and the world around us all changed politically, and that may have had a lot to do with it. I think there was some creative things and storyline things that might have been still getting worked out, but that's what pilots are for.
Yeah,
I think the concept, though, they were pretty happy with at the time that it was being produced and shot, that it was going to be something great. And I think maybe people got nervous. I can't speak to it, but that would have been a good one.
Yeah, it would have been great. I had my fingers crossed that we were going to land that one. And like you said, it was going to put a lot of people to work for a lengthy amount of time. And that would go so far to maybe not solving all of our issues we have here, but it would create so many opportunities, and it would give us so many chances to build, to grow, to show everyone else what we're capable of here, what we do here. Because a lot of what we do on a daily basis, it's not going into a movie theater. It's not maybe high profile. Maybe it is, but you know, it's a lot of just, we're all just working. We're just, you know, day to day.
Self-sustaining town.
There's absolutely nothing
wrong with that. In fact, I mean, it is good to know that there's enough work here, and maybe that's more important, because you'll see places where the incentives are initiated, but there's no industry to support it. But the government or the local government is like, you know, I'll just say even Detroit or Iowa, mm-hmm. where the incentives were very appealing and strong, and they came, but there wasn't the industry base to support it. So they still ended up bringing in all their crew. People took advantage of the situations, and eventually those markets didn't make it. Now, better for us that we have a self-sustaining market. So I think that's of the two, that's maybe the best thing to have, is to have a market where people can make a living, can build a career to a certain degree. I think what we're hoping is that there can be, that people can think bigger, do bigger, and we can support the people who actually are up and comers.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about maybe non-traditional or new emerging things like web series or things like that? Do you think, we have a couple people in town that seem to be doing a okay job with that. So is that maybe a growth area for us where we can carve out a bigger name for ourselves?
Certainly. I mean, I think any of that is great. I mean, if the web series can find the following, which I think is maybe the hardest part about web series is getting the following to keep it going. But yeah, I think those are all good avenues for our market to be nurturing and finding new talent.
So in your career as an AC and a cameraman and a owner of a rental house, what advice would you give to somebody who wants to, get into this on the production side?
Give it some time. That would be my biggest thing, is it takes a while to build the relationships. It takes a while to have enough people that are going to call you back to fulfill enough time in your calendar to call it a full-time job. You might have to do a few things, but I think give it some time and hang in there, and persistence does pay off if it's something that you want to do.
So can we geek out about cameras?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right.
We do all the time here.
All right. So for the last year, I've been working on a long-form documentary project, and we've been using the Red Helium, which is an 8K camera. So I wanted to ask you a couple questions. Number one, why the hell do we need 8K?
You don't.
But what advantages does it give us?
You know, it's a marketing advantage mainly for certain manufacturers, but I think the biggest advantage would be maybe there's some post advantages if you have the ability to back it up post-wise for effects work or for pulling stills or for reframing shots.
Okay, I think the whole thing with Red's marketing about you can forego hiring a photographer on your set because you can just pull stills from all your video.
Right.
And it's like, it's such bullshit because photographers don't shoot at a 48th shutter speed.
Right.
Ever. Because it's blurry.
Yeah, no, and we'd asked to do that a lot. And what we tend to do is do another take that's at a sharper shutter angle.
Yeah.
There is a way to trick it. if you do, I haven't messed around with it much, but if you do HDR, you can record one stream at one shutter angle and another stream at the 48th.
Oh, you can change shutter angle on...
Well, it does it for you. So you have to tell it how much to, much HDR to do. And you don't have to necessarily compile them together and do an HDR project, but you can have two streams.
Oh, I had no idea you could do that.
Huh. Yeah. And again, it's something that I know that people do it. I don't know exactly. There is a trade-off in exposure for the two, but I think the camera systems will boast there's enough that you can correct it. But essentially, that's how I understand HDR to work in the Red, in the sense that you pick your one shutter angle and frame rate, and the other one you tell it to compensate X amount of stops. But what it does is it does it with shutter angle.
Okay. Well, besides, you know, the go-to of like, well, you can always, edit at HD or 4K and then you can punch in on the 8K, which, yeah, you can reframe, you can do that all day long, it's fine. But maybe one other advantage you might get is the noise profile at 8K when it is res down for, say, HD or 4K, that noise then minimizes. So there's an advantage there, right?
There is, yeah. There certainly is. They're much cleaner pictures now, and you can get away with a lot of that as far as that goes. I think you have to be beholden to the workflow as designed. And that's the part that people don't always do. They transcode it, edit it, and they don't always get back to the other. So they end up grading a transcoded format in a lot of cases. And for some projects, it works completely fine. I think the way it was designed was not necessarily that. It was to always go back to the raw for your effects work, always go back to the raw for your color grading. And a lot of post flows aren't able to achieve that, maybe in the timeline, and they still shot 8K, but they can't edit in 8K. They don't have a color grading session scheduled. So in a sense, a lot of the towel's been thrown in on the intended workflow of the camera.
Well, it does seem like, yeah, Reds are kind of ubiquitous. Like, I ran into a screenwriter a while back who literally is a screenwriter, and he had the Red Dragon. And I was like, why did you spend all that money? Well, because when I'm ready to do my thing, I got the gear. And I was like, but are you ready? Like, no. I don't know. It just was like, I don't know, what's the conspicuous consumerism or whatever it's called? Like, just
it's affordable and attainable now. So people look at that as tempting, and they feel like they're going to get everything out of it, but they don't always do, especially if they're trying to do two things. If you're going to be a cameraman, then it might make sense. But if you're buying it because you might have a project coming up, you might not need it.
Yeah. Yeah, especially because there are plenty of them around.
Yeah.
So
yeah, there's plenty of them around, and like what we do here is tend to talk about projects as they are, as a project, where there's different tools for different things. There's different cameras for different looks, different lenses for different looks and functions, and hopefully the approach is from that discipline. In a lot of cases, it's not always, and it can't always be, but not every camera is the camera for every job. Not every lens is the lens for every job. And that's where I think filmmakers who didn't buy equipment, I see their careers as much more diverse. Their reels is much more diverse. They're always able to experiment and to try new things.
Yeah, because if you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail kind of thing.
If you own it, your stuff... And I believe it. If you own it, your stuff starts to feel similar because it's the same style of stuff that's in your kit all the time. It doesn't mean that you're not making great pictures. I think it just means that those who chose to maybe not do that, their world opened up much more, and they probably have a much more rounded sense of different styles of filmmaking, different ways to use the tools than the everyday tools.
Yeah, I know, like working on this doc project, because I'm a Sony FS7 owner, and that's a workhorse of a camera. It does great for a lot of corporate commercial stuff, whatever. But like shooting the same interview, same scene on FS7 in S-Log 3 versus using the red helium in RAW, it's like a night and day difference. It's kind of like a FS7 compared to a DSLR. You know, you start looking at the highlight roll off and the dynamic range on the two cameras, and you're like, well, the FS7 is a great camera for sub $10,000 or around $10,000, but you know, the red kind of blows it away when you compare side by side, you know. So The dynamic range and resolution and the highlight roll off and all that stuff is just, it's so different and so much better, I would say. So yeah, I guess that was one thing I wanted to
know that from trying other things.
Yeah.
You know, from using a different camera than what maybe you were always using. And we find that people who shoot red a lot, when they finally shoot airy, their world opens up yet again to another workflow and another way and another imaging look, the way the colors work, maybe the ease of use. So it's good to always be trying to take things to the next step.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good advice. So don't necessarily rush out and buy a bunch of equipment. Just rent it as you need it and try all different options. So Arri is the gold standard, it seems like, in terms of color and quality. I mean, it's the, you know, you look at the stories that come out like, well, what were the films of Sundance shot on? What were the, you know, it's like Arri, you know.
It's amazing, yeah.
Yeah. What's so great about it? Is it just their color science? Is that nailed down and that good? Because it hasn't historically been about resolution for them. They've been slow to get on the 4K bandwagon, but.
Yeah. Arri will tell you that there's more to the quality and look of an image than resolution.
Yeah.
And they will say that we don't chase the market, we make the market. And they are the gold standard, partly because their history, but also the big part is because they really nailed it when they made the Alexa Classic. They were able to talk to filmmakers on how the camera should be used and the look and the functions and not having so many features. So yeah, there are things that any Arri camera won't do that the Red can do or Sony can do. A lot of those things in those cameras are marketed in a way that make it really appealing, but they never really get fully utilized. So Arri kind of, I see them as having stuck to the core of their history, which is supporting filmmakers and talking in a filmmaking language and creating a camera that will work and function and create the images that they want. Their workflow is quite easy. The camera's quite easy to use. So what I find with Arri, and I shoot Red all the time, but what I find with Arri is that you spend more time talking about the images and the composition and the story. Maybe it's because of you're not talking about the tech and the menus and the resolution options and all the other things that might bog down maybe what you're trying to do. The amount of conversations you have in a Red camera job than you have in a Arri job are significant, I think. And both good and bad, but just something about what Arri's done as far as nailing the color right out of the box so people can get on with the next step of the process, which might be grading or coloring or editing, and not any time really fixing or sorting or trying to figure out how to get enough space on a hard drive.
Yeah.
You know, there are things like that. When you're having to go back and forth from a super high-res file to the transcoded file, it's a step. It's a hiccup. It can be a thing.
Because probably what maybe beginners don't realize is that when you make a proxy file of an 8K, you have a 4K file. And if you can't even edit a 4K file, like then you got to knock it down even smaller, you know, where it's like, I don't know, whatever. Yeah, I mean, I've built multiple giant RAID systems for this project that we're working on. So, you know, we thought we could get by with one, and we've got two identical ones just because so much storage space is demanded with that kind of raw footage.
Yeah. So it's a lot of tech time. But
yeah.
Arri is just something about that camera is a pleasure. I don't know what it is. It's just a pleasure to work with. People enjoy it. ACs like it. Movies like it. People like it for handheld. People like it for studio work. It's just it kind of is a camera that people can kind of polish the product all the way, from the sound guy to the colorist to the editor, because there hasn't been something that's bogged them down, that's derailed them. They can just be the professional they are for what they're hired to do.
Yes, that's a good way to put it. And it's a good thing to consider on your projects. Okay, one more geeky camera tech question for you. You mentioned kind of maybe that resolution is not the end-all, be-all important thing we should be focusing on. What about HDR, like true high dynamic range? Is that, and people can actually see that. I mean, that's a tangible thing. If you show someone, they're going to notice it. So is that something we should be looking forward in the next year or two?
It's definitely sort of the next step in tech, in both monitors and cameras, as far as something that is a noticeable improvement. We haven't done much of it here. I don't know much about it, but it definitely is the...
Well, I mean, most of our cameras have been capable of capturing more than what broadcast can support, for sure.
Yep. So we're going to start seeing more use of HDR monitors, more use of an HDR finish. But again, it's still like, right now, I feel like a lot of people are pretty content with where they are technologically, that the next hurdle, people got to want to learn it and know it and do it.
Mm-hmm.
And we've gotten to a point where tech's kind of exhausted us. And people are pretty happy with the cameras they're using right now. And the improvements are a little bit more incremental as far as what the next camera can do.
Mm-hmm.
That HDR is definitely not necessarily incremental, but I just think it's like people are pretty satisfied right now in a lot of cases that there should be something somewhat noticeable, which HDR is, that's going to push it to the next level. And that it's probably going to happen, but we haven't seen it. Whole lot of it right now.
Yeah. And in your opinion, is full frame all that? I mean, we're not used to that. We've had, you know, 35 millimeter, super 35 millimeter format. So is full frame that much more glorious, that much more better, desirable, or is it just another tool that's going to be used?
It's definitely going to be another tool that's going to be used, but there is some glory to it for sure, in a narrative sense. It's pretty great. I don't know that the benefits of full frame will be required for every shot on every project all the time in a narrative sense, in the sense that everything has to be a really shallow depth of field or everything's like an epic landscape. I think right now it feels like it might be another tool for the high-end narrative. I don't know that people are so dissatisfied with what they're doing now that it's going to affect them as abruptly as it might be marketed. But when you start to use it and see it, it looks pretty amazing to see a nice wide lens with a little bit of focus fall off in the background. You get that selective focus that we haven't had in wider lenses. But a lot of the other stuff we can do with fast lenses and Super 35 sensors. But like anything else, technology moves on, and I think it's going to become more prevalent whether people want it or not. Optics are going to be a big part of whether it can succeed in the, you know, and how quickly it can succeed. Lenses are tricky right now because there's not a lot of them that cover full frame that people are passionate about. There's a lot of full frame lenses out there, but they might not be the ones that they feel are very, lenses are very personal. They really are. People have a reason that there's something that strikes them about the look of a lens or the way it captures the face or the roundness of something, or there's just something about it that cinematographers will love their Cook S4s forever, or they'll like the Primos or the Master Primes for certain things. And until we start seeing those in full frame, it's going to be hard to get them to shoot something else because they're pretty ingrained or passionate about something. So we'll see. It's coming. It's coming for sure.
All right. Well, with that, since we already talked about the state of filmmaking here in the North, is there anything else you want to cover? Any great stories you want to share, or advice to younger, less experienced operators?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think if you want to live in Minneapolis and Minnesota and be a filmmaker, there's a lot of great resources here. I think it's good to know that there are bigger things in other markets that you should probably try and get exposed to at some time. But you can do a lot of great things here in Minneapolis, and there's good crew. We hope we can continue to, you know, nurture more to give this market some legs. But I don't know. I've intended to live in Minnesota, so this is what it is for me.
Yeah, life is good here.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your time,
and thanks
for coming on Film 45.
No, excited to have the opportunity. Thank you.
All right. See you at the expo.
Yeah. Thanks.
Well, thanks for listening. I could have spent another hour geeking out about cameras and lenses with Steve, but he's thankfully had work to do, and I had to get back here and edit this episode. So some other time, perhaps. You probably don't want to listen to all that anyway. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Hope you learned something, and hope to see you at the expo. In the meantime, keep making films here in the North. Support your fellow filmmakers. Have fun and be good to each other. Bye-bye.
This has been a Film 45 podcast.